This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Writer Scott Hewler wanted to know more about the land under his house in Raleigh. You know, who owned it, who walked on it. So he does some research and he turns up this extraordinary book, A New Voyage to Carolina. This is a 1709 account of a two-month journey made by Jonathan Lawson through what was then a wild and undocumented place. As Scott Hewler delved into Lawson's account, he found an author with an astonishing perspective on a world that was on the precipice of change. Now, most of us would finish that book and put it on the shelf. Most of us would not finish that book. Most of us would start that book, look at the pictures, and put it on the shelf. But not Scott. No, no. He decides to recreate Lawson's voyage in a canoe, by foot. He traces the explorer's path and writes down his own account. It's a book now. It's called A Delicious Country. You can pick it up and read it cover to cover. Scott Hewler is with me now to tell us more. Welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be here, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Tell us more about this this scene. Well, I guess we need to know a little bit about Jonathan Lawson. I want to find out more about your discovery. But tell us a little bit about him and his first of all, his journey from London here and what he was looking for in the Carolinas.
Well, the great thing about Lawson is we know almost nothing about him. We know what he tells us in his book, which is that he came to Carolina and took a big walk and then hung around. But why he did that, we're not really sure. He tells us, we believe, according to most biographers recently, that he attended Gresham College in London in the late 17th century, where he would have seen the members of the Royal Society parading around. This was the very beginning of the scientific revolution. And we think he looked at those scientists the way Mark Twain would have looked at a steamboat pilot, or you and I grew up looking at astronauts like, oh, I'll have that. I want to do that. Yeah. So we get the sense that Lawson was looking for a way to impress people and to be part of this sort of scientific thing going on. And he was thinking of going to something called the Grand Jubilee, which was a big, basically, state fair that the Pope threw every 25 years because it was the 17th century. And what do people have to do? And, and somebody put his arm around him in London and said, well, you could go to Rome, but isn't that kind of 17th century? The 18th century is all happening over in North America. You should come here to Carolina. I got a boat waiting. Come on. Lawson goes to North Carolina. That's all we know. What was he looking for? Fun and adventure. He shows up in North Carolina, in South Carolina. It was a single colony then, Carolina. He shows up in Charleston in late 1700. And in December, he tells us, with five other Europeans and four Indian guides, one of whom was female, they got in a great big 10-person canoe and paddled up the coast. And that's all we know. Why? Because it sounded like a cool thing to do. I think less Lewis and Clark and more road trip. Think like Animal House.
Well, that and the fact that he's gonna discover these new species. I mean, if you're gonna be a scientist and you're gonna document these things, which was what they were doing back then in the 17th, 18th century, 18th and 19th century, you know, wow, wouldn't it be great to come to a place where I could find stuff that hasn't been documented before? So tell us about the journey. 2 months. Where'd he go?
Well, what he does is they paddle a canoe up the South Carolina coast, up to the mouth of the Santee River, which was at the time an enormously important river. I think it had the fourth highest discharge on the East Coast. And then I think they planned to paddle up the Santee and see how that went. It went very badly indeed. Santee was in flood. It was in freshet. It was pouring out. And so they got out of the canoe and they started walking. And they walked basically along the Santee, along, you know, ancient Indian paths all the way up the Santee to where the Watery and the Congaree join to form the Santee. And then he followed the Watery, which of course, you know, is also the Catawba. He's walking up to what you and I would call Charlotte. From there, he follows the old trading path, which not surprisingly is also the same route as the railroad and is also the same route as I-85. If that's the path that makes sense, people keep taking it. He follows that towards what's now Salisbury, what's now Hillsboro, and then he cuts, they learn, he and whoever's left with his trading party learned that there are Senecas in the nation and in the area, and nobody wants to mess with Senecas. Those are some bad dudes. And so they head, instead of continuing going north, they head east and end up in what you or I would call Little Washington, what the Indians probably called the place where that British guy lives with his daughter. And he showed up there. And on his way, he documented, we have stories in Lawson that we have nowhere else.
That's what, so tell me what he's interested in. What's he documenting?
He's like the best cultural anthropologist you've ever met before cultural anthropology was invented. He is describing the Indian practices. He describes their burial customs. He describes their food preparation customs. He describes barbecue. He describes their hunting. He describes their religion. He describes dancing. He is fascinated by these people. And what's really important to me about John Lawson is he sees them as fully human. And I think he's almost alone in his cohort. This is about 1700, which, as you know, there were basically two ways of looking at North America. One was, hey, you guys, look, a continent. It's free. Let's have it. With no mention that maybe it was somewhat in use at that point. And the other way was like, hey, you guys, a continent. Let's kill everyone here and then let's have it. No. So the sense that the Native Americans, that the Indian populations were fully human, that they counted, that they were real, that they had a culture, Lawson was almost alone in that deeply humane sense of the people he was meeting.
And at the same time, he's developing this relationship. He will go on to live with a native group for some time. But then he also talk about his ecological connections as well, because he's also documenting the flora and the fauna.
Right. He's really interested in sending botanical specimens back to England. The virtuosi, they were called, the collectors of the day. He has sent a letter to one James Petiver. We don't think that he got through, but when in 1708 he heads back to England to publish his book, the book he writes about not just his journey, but the 7 years or so he has spent living in the Carolinas, he meets Petiver, who was one of the great collectors of the day, and then he starts sending specimens to Petiver. Mm. And Lawson's specimens, dogwood, snake root, all these things that you and I know, become part of Petiver's collection. When Petiver dies, Hans Sloan buys Petiver's collection. And when Hans Sloan dies, that enormous collection becomes the foundation of the British Museum. So Lawson, this guy who almost nobody in North Carolina knows, his botanical specimens are in the collection that started basically the first modern museum. They're still there. You can go see them. I went to see them and touch them with my own little fingers. It was awesome. I can't recommend it highly.
Find out all the things you touched along the way in the Carolinas as well. But tell me how he was received at the time. Clearly he had an impact later on, but was anybody paying attention while he was there?
Well, while he was in Carolina, he was building a life for himself. When he was over in England, the Lord's proprietors, the eight white guys who owned everything, made him the surveyor general of the colony. And that meant that he got involved in the surveying of the Virginia border. That meant he helped found New Bern, which was the first capital. He helped found Bath, which was the first incorporated town. My feeling is that Lawson is North Carolina's William Penn. We should look at him as our first citizen, capital F, capital C, first European.
First European,
citizen.
Yeah.
And people really don't even know that he exists.
So you find this book, you get excited, and you decide to follow along. Talk about the journey that you
right.
took.
Well, I didn't want to slavishly foot after foot go exactly where Lawson was. What I wanted to do is what Lawson did. Basho has a quote that he supposedly said, don't seek to follow in the footsteps of men of old. Do what they did. Seek what they sought. And Lawson went out, and as I'm telling you, he looked around. He documented. He understood that he was walking on this knife edge of 50 years ago, the Indians were living the way Mississippian Indians had been living for 1,000 years. 50 years later, it was the United States, practically. It was a completely shifting time. I wanted to do the same thing and walk out and say, well, what's going on now? How do people live? How do they get their living? How do they eat their food? How do they pray? What do they believe in? What's important to them? And I found that I, too, was walking on this knife edge, that we're seeing the end of something, this sort of late capitalist collapsing economy, these abandoned little towns that I walked through. And so what I would do, I paddled up the coast just like he did, camped out every night or slept on someone's porch one night, things like that. And then over the course of the next year, for 2 or 3 days at a time, I would park my car where I planned to end, get someone to ferry me back to where I was starting, and then I would walk, and I would either camp, or I would sleep in someone's a basement, or I would sleep in a church pew, or wherever someone would give me to sleep, that's where I would go, and I would document what I saw on the website, lawsontrek.com, and kept up a constant tide of information about what I was seeing.
Now, you're kind of a weekend warrior because you had a job and a family, so you couldn't just set off for 2 months. And
right, yeah. Lawson didn't know anybody closer than 5,000 miles away, so for him to disappear into the bush and pop up 2 months later, that's fine. I had, you know, Sunday school carpool and Mighty Mites basketball to manage, so I couldn't just vanish.
So what did you, because also you met a lot of interesting people along the way who you found, shockingly enough, had these connections that they either knew or did not know to John Lawson.
It was amazing. Sometimes you'd gone along the trading path. People would have a sense that they were on the old trading path. But Lawson, I met Peggy Scott, the vice chief of the Santee tribe down on coastal South Carolina. And she told me that she never doesn't know where her copy of Lawson is. She said, Lawson gave me my history back. She described growing up as a young Indian girl as the third group in a binarily segregated culture. There was a drinking fountain for the white kids, and there was a kind of junky drinking fountain for the black kids. If an Indian child wanted a glass of water, the teacher or the principal had to go and bring you a little paper cup of water. So she felt, how much more marginalized could you feel? Then she went to college eventually, and she read Lawson, and she said, here is someone who is treating my people with respect. The current government doesn't even want to acknowledge that my tribe exists. Here is someone who talks about the Santee tribe and clearly loves them and was loved by them. So that was incredible to me, and that happened over and over. I met with people who were descendants of the Huguenot settlers. The first place Lawson and his gang set out for is the French Huguenot settlers that, you know, after the, you know, the Protestants had to leave Catholic France, and they ended up here. And he couldn't have been more complimentary about those settlers, and they took great care of him and were very kind to him. When I had stuff out on the website and my, you know, my Instagram and my Twitter feed all about what's going on in Lawson's world, I hear from someone who says, if you haven't left the area, would you like to see the original site of Jamestown that Lawson walked through? I was like, well, this is the stuff. That's exactly what I'm here to do. And so the next trip, I ended up sitting with me and an ecologist, Katie Winsett, who was walking with me. We ended up having bundt cake in the house of descendants of those Huguenots who somebody in their family tree would have sat and got drunk with Lawson in a situation Lawson describes. And Douglas Gary, who was the guy who put us up, he said he lived and was born within 2 miles of where his great 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 grandfather was born. So that's what I was walking through, is people who have been here a long time and have thoughts about their culture,
about what is being lost. As you say, in many ways, as Europeans came, they quickly made native populations very much marginalized, left behind. Now we're seeing late-stage capitalism. Our own population, upwards of 70% of the people in our own country, are in that same. So you're on this, as you said earlier, this knife edge, which Lawson understood he was standing on. Fascinating comparisons. Little things, too, that are kind of marvelous along the way. As you noticed, native burial mounds you started to make, or mounds of various kinds, they weren't all burial mounds, you started to realize that there's some pretty sharp similarities there, too.
Absolutely. One of the things that we notice constantly is that it's roads, 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 roads. And, of course, there's no sidewalks. And we live in a world that's designed for cars, not for people. And as I was walking into the town of Camden in South Carolina, you walk under a highway ramp, and I looked at the two, the mounds underneath the ramp going up over the road, and I thought, that looks almost exactly the same shape as the Santee burial mound that's this enormously important cultural artifact on the coast of South Carolina, in coastal South Carolina. And so I reached out to an engineer. I was like, what's the deal here? And he said, if you're going to build a mound out of earth, it's got to have a basic shape. It's got to have a basic slope, because if it's too steep, it's going to collapse. And if it's, you know, and it'll erode away. And so what you're going to want is this kind of like 1-3 or 1-4 slope, as I recall, is what he said. And so I loved that sudden sense that when the Santee built a mound, or when the Mississippian Indians built a mound 1,000 years ago, it looked a certain way. And when we wanted to build a mound for a highway, it was just going to have to look the same way.
There are certain rules that we can't violate, right. Although we came here and violated so many basic rules of human behavior, including, and one I think that came up in sharp relief, you talked about the people you met along the way. Sounds like you had some great interactions. You can see and read about all the people you met along the way. But there was one lady, when you wanted to camp, that I think.
Yeah, that was very strange. As I say, it was enormously generous. I met with generosity, 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 same as Lawson had. But there was this one situation. I did a thing that meant a lot to me that I had wanted to do. I've been a longtime camper, a longtime backpacker, but you're always in parks and things like that. One day on this trek, I did something I've always wanted to do. I got up in the morning, packed up my tent, put on my backpack, walked, had my meals, walked for the course of a day. When it started to get dark out, I looked for a place to stop. And I didn't care where it was. I wasn't going to, you know, camp in somebody's backyard next to their grill. But I found a little copse of trees. I set up my tent. I laid down and I slept. And I got up in the morning and I packed up my tent and off I went. And with no sense of who owns this land, it wasn't important. I walked. I laid down on God's green earth and I got back up and I walked. I thought that was very satisfactory. And there was one place that a friend of mine tried to set me up to walk through a plantation grounds, an old plantation. And the woman who was in charge of it was a little concerned about who I was and what my crazy notion was. And I was explaining, well, I'm walking and I'm, you know, recreating this journey, but I'm looking around and just trying to document what I see. And she said, well, okay, well, so like, where are you like sleeping? And I said, well, I sleep here. Somebody let me sleep on their front porch. Somebody put me in their basement. Somebody put me in a church pew of a little church that they owned. Sometimes I'm in tents. Sometimes I'm in cabins here and there. And I said, and one night, in fact, I told her that little story. And she said, well, then that's all there is, really. I'm certainly not going to let you on my property if that's your approach to private property. And I was astonished, this sense of like, my ancestors stole it fair and square from the Indians, and so don't you be, you know, disrespecting my property rights.
We had to kill people to steal this land. Now you get off.
Yeah, well, that's in essence, that's what it was.
But as you say, it wasn't mostly it was an amazing, astounding journey, and you've given us, I mean, I think to some degree. Jonathan Lawson, John Lawson, do you think, are we going to be paying, obviously we should, but any indication that we will be paying more attention to John Lawson?
Oh, I so much hope so. I really want Lawson. He was a man of his time. He had no trouble buying, quote in quotes, land from the Indians and developing it. And he was, you know, problematic in all the ways, but overwhelmingly he was respectful and he loved these people that he was meeting. And despite the fact that they killed him at the end, which was a shame. But I really do hope that people get a sense of what an important observer of early colonial Carolina Lawson was, and that we start to give him a little more respect.
Well, thanks for getting us started, Scott Hueller, author of Delicious Country, Rediscovering the Carolinas Along the Route of John Lawson, 1700 Expedition. Scott is also senior writer at Duke Magazine. Always good to see you. Thanks, Scott.
Thanks for having me.
And Scott's going to be speaking at Motorco tonight in Durham, going to be at McIntyre's Books in Pittsburgh March 16th, Country Bookshop in Southern Pines on April 10th. We've got all of that at our website, stateofthings.org. Talking about reading and writing and great authors of North Carolina, we're going to find out why a 19th century novelist lost his career after being one of the most popular African-American writers in the country. We'll talk about that on The State of Things after this.